was music from Ladysmith Block Mombazo, along with the English Chamber Orchestra Jabulani, which means rejoice. And we're joined by Doug Greenwald from Preserving Bible Times out in Columbia, Maryland. Doug, good morning to you. Welcome to the party this morning.
Well, thank you. What are you celebrating? The last ice is off the lakes in Minnesota?
No earthquakes in Oklahoma. That's what I'm celebrating today.
Yeah, they've had a rash of earthquakes. Of course, Sharon out in Oklahoma City. What did you say? They're not counting more earthquakes in Oklahoma than California over the past year or so?
There have been more 3.0 or larger earthquakes mm-hmm. in Oklahoma in the past year than there have been in California.
Well, congratulations on that one, Doug. No,
if you live in Oklahoma, you got stuff going on above ground and below ground.
Yeah,
absolutely. You don't know where to take shelter.
Mm-hmm. And as of 2 weeks ago, there was still icebergs on Lake Superior.
Really? I didn't know. Okay. It's been a long winter. Doug, you're in a hot and humid place. What's the weather like in Columbia, Maryland?
We're pushing 90 most days now, fortunately the humidity hasn't yet gotten up that high.
Okay.
But we may be on the cusp of getting there here within a week.
I know, it's hot and humid.
Even though it's been in the high 80s, 90, it's been nice.
Okay. Well, what was the weather like in Italy? Now, Doug, of course, just a little background here. Doug, of course, the senior teaching fellow at Preserving Bible Times and the executive director thereof, and just returned from Italy on the very first of Preserving Bible Times Pauline Studies tours. And we've been learning about the background, the context, the culture, the mix of cultures that the Apostle Paul had to deal with back in the first century. What was the weather like when you were there? You were there in May.
We were there in the first 2 weeks of May, mm-hmm. and I would say it was typically 70 degrees and sunny.
Oh,
we saw
nice.
Rain for probably 90 minutes during that 10-day period mm-hmm. of time, and never wore a sweater. So it was lovely.
Well, Preserving Bible Times takes care of everything on those tours, don't they, then?
Well, we've been really blessed with weather. And the day we were down in the Sorrentine Peninsula and took the ferry from Sorrento to Capri, it was a brilliant blue sky, sunny day. And that is just a gorgeous island. It's basically a mountain that rises out of the sea. And it has all these grottos, and it's where Tiberius ruled the Roman Empire for 12 years. There's a Villa Jovis at the very top of one of the, I'll call it a mesa, to use a southwestern United States term here, a mesa on the top of this rock.
Mm-hmm.
And there he retreated from Rome. Never did like to do administration, never really liked the idea of being Caesar. So he kind of got away from things there, and he let his lieutenant, Sejanus, run things from Rome for 12 years. That's a whole other story by itself, but Sejanus is the one who appointed Pontius Pilate to oversee Judea, and Sejanus was detected by Tiberius, at least to Tiberius's way of thinking, as being part of a coup maybe 9 months before the trial of Jesus, and Sejanus got sacked. And so this is part of Pilate's predicament when he's dealing with Jesus during Passion Week. He's got a new boss to contend with, Tiberius, no longer Sejanus. And what's the politically correct thing to do to keep Sejanus happy, et cetera, et cetera. So it's fascinating how, you know, the dots come together. And that whole issue was unfolding while Tiberius was on top of the island of Capri at his fabulous villa up there. And we had the privilege of visiting Capri that day and appreciating part of that, I'll call it, greater context at 30,000 feet.
Mm-hmm. Well, the political life in ancient Rome was wild and woolly, wasn't it? It was dangerous.
Well, it was. You see, they had a process for selecting someone to be Caesar, but they had no process to get rid of Caesar when Caesar started to go bad. And so that's why it got bloody, and that's why Caesars got murdered, and there was all these conspiracies going around. And it was high risk to be a Caesar, particularly when things weren't going well.
You know, I'm starting to see that time and that place, particularly Rome, and particularly the upper echelons of the Roman hierarchy, is like a magnet for the Christian faith. It's almost as if the center of Christianity, it begins in the Holy Land, in Jerusalem or in Galilee, perhaps, and then it kind of gradually shifts to the west, and then all of a sudden gets sucked right into Rome with the end of Peter and the end of Paul, and their beheading in about what 65 A.D.
Yeah, and in terms of Paul himself, it'd be 67 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
The notion here that it gets taken to Rome, and then it gets embraced, it starts to catch on in Rome, and then Constantine comes along, and suddenly the whole world is under the umbrella of Christianity in a favorable way, not an unfavorable way. It's rather a remarkable turn of events over three centuries.
What's the history of Peter? Now, you've talked in this context of Peter and Paul, or kind of like Peter versus Paul, and the evangelical row they had to hoe. Each of them was so different. Peter in Jerusalem for so many years. He was in Ephesus. He went to Babylon for a while, but he ended up in Rome somehow. Might that have been because of Paul? Do you have any idea, any notion? Because my knowledge of that part of the history is zilch. How did Peter start heading into Rome, and why?
Well, I suspect it's more related to the fact that the whole world is the Holy Roman Empire at that point in time, and that's the center of gravity, and major issues get decided in Rome, major things happen in Rome. I have not researched that. I've just now been trying to dig into Paul's life here, and that's going to be a whole journey by itself, but my suspicion is that it has to do with the Holy Roman Empire being headquartered in Rome, so to speak. And so if you've got to deal with major issues regarding religion, faith, it may force you to end up in Rome to deal with some of these things.
Well, I've got to wonder if he wasn't maybe trying to mollify or modify perhaps the Roman hierarchy's view toward Israel and Jerusalem in particular, because that was just a few short years until Jerusalem came tumbling down and the temple.
Jerusalem, or Israel, as we have observed in past broadcasts here, was particularly crucial to the Roman way of thinking and understanding things, because Israel is the buffer zone between the Western world of Rome and their biggest concern, the Parthians, on the other side of what we now know as Jordan. The Parthians being the only people who ever defeated a Roman legion. And so part of Rome's preoccupation with Israel and wanting to make sure that place is secure and not seditionist is because its role in part is to serve as a buffer zone between the Parthians and the Roman world.
Mm-hmm. Well, lots of political intrigue going on there, and you can see how Israel, kind of between the two worlds, right on the border, betwixt and between, was kind of a, it was a crossroads, wasn't it? I mean, everybody crossed through Israel to get to where they were going. That was true economically, militarily, politically.
It certainly was true in the Old Testament world. It was the crossroads of three continents. It was the land bridge, if you will, between three continents. The major invasion routes, the major trade routes from three continents all passed through Israel. Small though it may be, it was probably the most strategic piece of real estate in antiquity, none of which should surprise us. Everything God does is intentional, and he picked the most strategic place to start to reveal himself. And it also tells us what the purpose of the land is, to reveal the one true God to the world, that God would bring a trampsing through this world. It also tells us what the role of the people in that land was supposed to be, working in concert with the one true God to accurately reveal and portray him to all the peoples of the world who would come trampsing through this land. And as we know, the Israelites resented other people coming into their land rather than embracing that opportunity to share Yahweh with them, and often found themselves at cross purposes as to what God's intent was. And that's part of the view from 5,000 feet, you know, as you look back over the Old Testament and understand geography and trade routes and land masses and continents, and start to connect the dots in God's intentionality with those things.
Now, I know that a number of the apostles, the original 11, you know, 12 minus 1, generally worked to the east. They stayed in Jerusalem for a number of years, although I guess Peter had gone to Babylon in the mid-40s A.D. But if you look at tradition and what little written history there is of these people, most of their work was done eastward into what's now Iran and Iraq, and north toward the Caspian Sea, and even south into India, where Thomas supposedly went. Peter kind of straddled the area in between, Turkey, Asia Minor, for a while. How did Paul get into the picture? We know about the road to Damascus, but what made Paul the guy, the go-to guy, maybe the plan B for God? Huh?
Well, he was born in Asia Minor, in a Jewish community, which was part of a much greater Greco-Roman world, and so he was classically trained in Judaism, observant Judaism. He was classically trained in the rabbinic method, but yet he was totally surrounded by the Greco-Roman world the whole time. And so he is a man for all seasons in that sense. He understands the Jewish mind, the Jewish world, the Jewish scriptures, and yet he understands the Roman worldview and the way the Roman world works. And so he could be a man for all seasons. When in Rome, he was a Roman. When in Mars Hill, he was a Greek, and could perfectly function, I guess we'd use the word spiritually ambidextrous, maybe, in both of those worlds.
And when he traveled, we've classified him, his travels basically into three missionary trips. He tended to go to synagogues first. Why do you suppose that was the case?
Well, because it was a known geographical place. It's where Jews he knew would congregate. He might be able to find there some wealthy Jews who maybe had a very nice villa, who, if they had a villa, would have had a lovely atrium. And that atrium could well have been ground zero for the house church, for the new believers in Jesus, the Gentiles, as well as the Jews, in that community. So it was a logical place to go. He knew the Jewish world. He knew where he could find them in the synagogue. And he wanted to tell them that Messiah really indeed did come. And his name is Yeshua, and you can see all sorts of his footprints through the Old Testament. And so he would argue and do his apologetics to the Jews. Sometimes that worked, sometimes that didn't work so well, because as we say about Paul, whenever he entered a city, there was either a revival or there was a riot.
Yeah, and he was abused, hurt, maybe near death, maybe. He talks about going into the it's the third heaven, he says, I believe. Do you suppose that could have been a near-death experience, perhaps after a stoning or a scourging?
Well, there are many ways to look at things like that, but what I think I'd like to do is to get back to the theme that we set in motion last week, that we said we were going to follow up today, and that is to look at some of what Paul has written and look at some of the imagery that he has used, and to point out how significant some of his statements were that have been misunderstood and misinterpreted through time. And and then the case I want to talk about this morning, even the profound misimpact that has had on us in understanding almost the core of the faith. And having set the stage that way, you may remember when we were in Advent season, in past years, sometimes we would talk about the birth of Jesus and how that word translated in Luke 2:8, there was no room for them in the inn. The word really is kataluma, and that means guest room. And we've long known that the word means guest room, and yet translation after translation comes out and says there was no room for them in the inn, and how that really throws us off the path of understanding the significance of what happened to them that night. That's actually Luke 2:7 to be exact here. Because when we translate the word kataluma as inn, as if it was Motel 6, then we sort of lapse into logic that says, well, here come Mary and Joseph at 10 o'clock at night, and all the rooms are taken in Motel 6, and so there's a no vacancy sign out there, and therefore there was no room for them in the inn. That really throws us off the path, Because the word that has been mistranslated in is Cataluma. And if we understand it as guest room, we have to then ask, why are the 300 guest rooms, because each of the small homes in Bethlehem that night would have had a Cataluma, a guest room, why are all 300 of those rooms off limits to this member of the clan, the Davidic clan, who's, with Mary being very pregnant and about to provide delivery, she has the highest pecking order, the highest priority for hospitality of anyone in the clan. And yet no one will open up their guest room for this couple. And so understanding it that way raises a huge question as to why all these Catalumas are not available to Mary and Joseph. And the answer, I would suggest, is one of shame. They're perceived as an adulterous couple. No one's going to get their house ritually unclean by letting them in. And so we have a whole different understanding of what was going on the birth night of Jesus. And it all hinges around this one word, Cataluma, mistranslated in, correctly translated guest room, and the respective implications that we can draw from both views, both the historical treatment and what I would suggest is the appropriate treatment. And then when you dig around, you find out that no, it's no secret that the word is Cataluma. I've actually been at Christian publishers talking about this, and what you hear is, we know it's wrong, but we don't dare change it, because tradition has a stronger grip on us sometimes than does the truth itself. And if we were to change that word in back to guest room, people would think we've mishandled the translation here, and this is not a very accurate Bible, and it would hurt our sales. And so it's really fascinating how one word gets treated or not treated, even when we know it's been mishandled, as in this case of Cataluma. And with that as a backdrop, I now want to go over into Paul's life and talk about a word that he used. It's called doulos, D-U-L-O-U-S. It's a Greek word that means slave. And Paul says, we are called to be slaves of Christ. In fact, some argue that the word Christian, from a word origin perspective, really is the word that's derived from slaves for Christ. I can't speak to that. It's an interesting speculation. I'm sure there's some people who understand the origin of words that might be intrigued by that. But when it came time to translate the word doulos in the phrase slaves for Christ, in 1611, when the King James translators were doing their work, they shied away from using the word slave for political reasons, because they felt the word slave had the wrong connotations for British society. And they didn't want to set that kind of thinking in motion. And so they chose instead the word servant. And so that word servant in place of doulos for slave has held on for hundreds and hundreds of years in translations. People know it's been wrong. Apparently very few people. And this sort of notion has carried along for centuries now that Paul calls us to be servants of Christ. Well, John MacArthur, who I think you've probably heard of him, this is about 7 years ago, is reading on one of his trips a book where somebody is developing the fact that doulos has been mishandled through the centuries. It really meant slave, not servant. And the light bulbs went off in MacArthur, and he started to research this. And he wrote a book that came out about 4 years ago called Slaves, in which in his prologue he said, had I known that the word translated servant really it meant slaves, it would have saved me writing half the books that I've written. Because it is so foundational to our identity in Christ, how do we see ourselves in Christ, that the word slave is so much richer of a word than is the word servant. Now, when we use the word slave, we have to get out of our antebellum South cotton plantation, black oppressed environment. That's the American understanding of slave. And we have to go back to the first century, to the Roman world. And depending on who you read, either as low as a fifth or as high as half of all the people in the Roman world were slaves. It's a very, very large socioeconomical band of people. Basically, whenever Rome conquered another land, all those people became slaves. And so they would be brought back to slave markets in Rome or all throughout the Roman world. And they were public slave markets, and people, masters, could walk around and determine which slaves they wanted to buy. And each one of those slaves would have a placard around their neck describing their attributes. They could have been a doctor, or a lawyer, or an engineer, or a teacher, or a bookkeeper, or an auditor, or a cook, or a metal worker. Whatever it was, that would be written on their placard. And the master, who wanted a certain kind of capability for his household, would read all these placards and buy the slave that had the best description of what he wanted for his house. And he would purchase that slave. And see, this is a huge difference between the word servant and the word slave. A slave is owned by the master. A servant is hired by the master. Mm-hmm. Okay? So when Paul is working on this, what is our identity in Christ, he wants this image that you are totally owned by your master, Jesus Christ. Okay? You haven't hired yourself out to him. It's just a huge difference from an emphasis point of view, from a word understanding point of view, from a contextual point of view. And he owns you. And whatever he says, of course you're going to do. And because he owns you, you want to do whatever you can to please him. So you, if you're a slave, you wake up in the morning and you say, how can I please my master today? What can I do that will bring him great pleasure? Whereas you're a servant, it's more, much more of a passive role. You stand around and wait for the master to tell you to do something, and then you either wholeheartedly or reluctantly, externally or internally, go do it. And so there's another thing about slaves. They're so valued by their masters that they're often treated as just members of the family, almost like an adopted son, if you will. When you get into these villas that you find in Pompeii and Herculaneum in southern Italy, you realize that these villas have a central entrance called the vestibulum, and on either side of that are two pretty sizable rooms that have access to the street, and that's where the slaves would conduct entrepreneurial activities. The masters encouraged their slaves to conduct businesses, and they were entitled to earn money. They were entitled to keep that money, and they were entitled, if the master agreed, to buy their freedom. And a lot of slaves chose not to buy their freedom, even though they were free to do that, because they so valued being in the family and serving their master. And so that's part of the contextual backdrop here that Paul has in mind when he talks about slaves of Christ instead of just servants for Christ that we've been living with for the better part of 300 years, ever since the King James translator sort of set that boat in motion.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting thought is, and you've mentioned this on a past program or two, that slaves could also become Roman citizens, couldn't they? Citizens of their new kingdom, if you will.
Yes, when they bought their freedom, they changed their category from slave to freedman, and that generally brought with it Roman citizenship as well. And that's why a lot of people in foreign lands who were conquered wanted to be sold off into slavery, because it was the only avenue to become a Roman citizen. Mm-hmm. But with that as a backdrop, and now I want to get to a great passage in Luke 19. Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. He has just called Zacchaeus down from the sycamore fig tree. He has just spent an evening at Zacchaeus' house. And he has just pronounced in verse 19:10 of Luke, "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost," i.e. the Zacchaeuses of the world. And while he is still there, in Zacchaeus' household, verse 11 picks up, "While they were listening to these things, Jesus went on to tell a parable. because he was near Jerusalem, and they supposed that the kingdom of God was going to appear immediately. And that gets us into the Jewish worldview of the first century, which is this: when Messiah comes, he will go straight to the temple and reign, and there will be peace, prosperity, and social justice. And I would suggest that the disciples are very much into this mindset, that Jesus is about to go to the temple, throw out the chief priest and the high priest, take over temple rulership, establish his earthly political military kingdom, get the Romans out of Israel, and finally Jews will be governing Jews again, like it was back in the time of David and Solomon, and like it was with the Hasmonean dynasty until Pompey and the Roman legion came into Israel in 63 BC. So now Jesus wants to get that thought out of their mind, okay? So he says this in verse 12 of chapter 19. So Jesus said, "A nobleman went to a distant country to receive a kingdom for himself and then return. And then he called 10 of his slaves and gave them 10 minas and said to them, 'Do business with this until I come back.'" Now, those two verses are absolutely loaded with this Roman context here. And this particular parable didn't jump off the page until about 2 weeks ago for me, when I had come back from this Pauline trip and started to process a lot of what we learned, including this whole contextual backdrop of slaves here. Jesus is using Roman talk in Zacchaeus' house, talking to his disciples and the other listeners, in verses 12 and 13. The word nobleman is not a Jewish word. It's not a Jewish notion. And the word slaves is very, utterly Roman. And so my first question was, does his disciples, or do his disciples, even understand Roman culture? And I have to conclude yes, because Jesus is using Roman language here, Roman concepts, noblemen and slaves. And if I stop to think about it, there was a very large Roman city called Sepphoris, just 4 miles north of Nazareth in the Galilee. And Tiberias was another large Roman city. That's where Herod Antipas is ruling at the time of Jesus. And those would have been very Greco-Roman worlds, and they would have had slaves and noblemen. And so, yes, while we tend to think of the Galilee as mostly a Jewish operation, there may have been more Gentiles in the Galilee region than there were Jews. And so it's reasonable to assume that his disciples would have had some working understanding of the Greco-Roman world. And then when you nose around some more and you look at John, is it John 4 here? Yes, at the end of John 4, verse 46, "Therefore, when Jesus came again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine, there was a royal official whose son was sick at Capernaum." In the Greek, the word royal official is basilikos. And that's a word for the administrative center, the record-keeping center for the Roman Empire. It's from where the word basilica comes from, when the record-keeping buildings became churches. And so right there, never saw that before either, in John 5, is a Greek administrative term, basilikas, to describe this royal official. And so there would have been a Roman record-keeping operation. And so when the centurion in Matthew 8, who's based in Capernaum, comes to Jesus and says, "Not my servant, my doulos, my slave is sick," once again, an entirely different cast and spin on the significance of that slave to the centurion. So this is really exciting to me to open these things up in deeper ways here. So let's pick up. We still have a little bit of time left here. "A nobleman went to a distant country to receive a kingdom for himself." This is very common to the Middle East, because whenever Rome conquers a region, there's a whole bunch of little wannabe kings who then petition the Roman Senate, "Will you make me your puppet king for the land you've just conquered?" That's part of Rome's subjugation strategy. That's how Herod the Great got to be king of Judea. In about 40 BC, he went to Rome and beseeched the Roman Senate to make him king of this land that they recently conquered. And there were others who also went who were trying to get that designation. It's very competitive. And so this part of the world is very familiar when a nobleman goes to a distant country, i.e. Rome, to try and receive a kingdom for himself. Then he called 10 of his slaves and gave them 10 minas and said to them, do business with this. Now, if the master tells his slaves to do something, this is the first thing they want to do. If this pleases my master, this is what I want to do. So if he said, go do business with these minas, that's what I'm going to do. I can't wait to do it. I'm here to please my master. And also, parenthetically, let me observe here that what's said here is not go make a profit for me. It's just transact business for me. Be identified with me in the marketplace while I'm gone.
Oh, hit your button here, Doug. There you go.
And it won't be risky because I am going to return. Verse 12, he gives him assurance that not only is he going away, and the metaphor here is to heaven, okay, but I will return triumphant. So you can stand for me, you can identify with me in the marketplace and not be worried that when I return, I will have lost. And my competitor for this kind of thing, keeping this business analogy intact here, is going to try and do you harm. Now, the fact that he says do business really fits nicely with this notion of the two rooms in a Roman villa that faced the streets where slaves were encouraged to do business in the master's household. And so all of a sudden, and I realize I have to truncate this parable here, but it just starts to jump off the page for me once we get this understanding of the word slave appropriately in place. It's Roman world, first century context in place. And once again, shouldn't be surprised, these parables of Jesus get to be richer and deeper.
Well, I can hardly wait till we pick up where we left off here. I'm kind of sad to stop here, but this has been enlightening to say the least. And Sharon, any thoughts?
I'm just still drinking it in.
Mm-hmm. As am I.
And there's so much there.
And David, are you still here? I think you are. Oh, David may not. David, since getting back from Africa, has been in demand. His phone's been ringing all morning, and things are going on. So I'll tell you what, we'll wrap it up. This podcast will be posted on our website in just a couple of hours at brokenroadradio.com. And if you go to brokenroadradio.com, you will see a link to Preserving Bible Times. You can visit their website. And Doug, you have some pictures up from the Italy trip?
They are. They're all there. My Italy trip report, overviewing a lot of these kind of observations, is there on the website. And perhaps it might be appropriate just to close this morning by saying, nice to be with you slaves.
Well, I will readily admit to being a slave, wholeheartedly.
And every morning when we wake up, we need to adopt the spirit of a slave. What can I do to please my master today, not to be just a reluctant servant in his kingdom?
Well, we're doing business for him 24 hours a day here at Broken Road Radio, and just so glad to be a slave. And especially in the context that you've given it, it's quite a change from the traditional or the usual American presumption about what slavery was. And we've learned a lot. So, Doug, again, thanks so much for the time. You're very generous with that. And we'll check with you again next Wednesday. Are you available next Wednesday? I know you're busy.
Yes, I am.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. We can make it. Maybe we can pick up where we left off with
Herod. Okay, we have to do that.
Okay. Doug, take care of yourself.
Shalom.
Bye-bye.
Shalom.
Yeah, Doug, before you go.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I thought you were clipping off there.
Oh.
I just got back from Malawi from the mission trip, and their country has a background of slavery, you know, from the Muslims, back in the 19th and early 20th century. It's 18th century as well. And so they see slavery as, you know, much the same context as we in the West do. But they are the recipients of it. They would be interested in this context as well. Now, the second message I have is there's a radio station over in Malawi, there's a number of them, but one of them is run by the Assemblies of God Church, and a friend of mine works there, I've given her our email address and suggested that they listen to your programs.
Mm-hmm. It would be good for everyone to do that.
Yeah.
Doug, we'll see you next week.
Okay. Shalom, shalom.
Bye-bye.
Shalom, Doug.